Welcome to episode 132 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including your Pokedex. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uessa. Hello, Daniel. How are you doing?
Good, thank you, Mark. Welcome to 2026, new year, first regular episode in a little while. I've got lots to talk about today. Our first big featured review in a little while, but also lots else to catch up on. We've got three courses of games to discuss. But I thought first maybe we could talk a little bit about our holidays and like what we got up to gaming wise, otherwise maybe some aspirations for the new year. What did you? How was your break, Mark?
Yeah, my break was pretty good. I will say that I didn't really get as down to as much gaming as I would like, particularly in the tabletop kind. You know, of course, I had the fantasy that I would be sitting around the table with my brood playing card games and laughing it up and, you know, take that and this and that. But it didn't end up happening with get-togethers and concerts and meals.
And they've got new Christmas toys to play with.
Yeah, exactly. So mostly it was just me playing retro games. I was able to focus on a few more specifically, which I might translate into reviews later on. But yeah, not terribly exciting in terms of the game front. How about yourself?
Yeah, well, I mean, I also used the opportunity to basically catch up on my retro backlog. I already had a few banked, and now I've got like 8 or 9 that I finished in the last couple of months, basically, that I was planning to talk about. But maybe we'll just have to do like one big retro roundup at some point and talk through some of those. But also did, of course, pick up a couple of things in the various end of year sales. And I was planning to catch up on a few like smaller indie games to round out the end of the year for our, you know, game of the year discussions last week. Basically ended up getting caught up in baby steps for most of the holiday break, which I'll just be discussing in detail in a future episode as well. But that sort of absorbed a lot of my time. But importantly, did also let me catch up on a lot of my YouTube backlog. So a lot of interesting videos, both gaming and otherwise, that I've been catching up on. And a couple of those I'll be sharing later today.
Cool. Yeah, one thing I was just reminded of that was new for the holidays is that I ended up getting a Switch 2. It was a big holiday present, so I guess I knew that was coming. We, you know, played some Mario Kart around the living room at Christmas time. So I guess that was as much family bonding as we did. And aside from that, my oldest has gotten the most use out of that machine. But we don't have any big titles that are screaming, hey, look at me, I'm a new console, other than Mario Kart. So, you know, we don't have Donkey Kong, Bonanza. I haven't even tried any of the, you know, souped up versions of the old, like, Zeldas that...
I hope you're willing to pay for those.
No, but I have the Nintendo Switch Online.
Oh, yeah, so some of those are free, aren't they? Yeah,
The upgrade packs are included. So I actually do need to go back to Tears of the Kingdom. So that's the second one, right?
Yes. Is it?
I always get those names mixed up. Yeah, so I do actually need to finish Tears of the Kingdom, and I'm hoping that with Switch 2, the machine will actually be powerful enough to give that game justice. It was a bit chuggy and slow on the old platform, so I'm actually hopeful, but nothing's like compelling me. I guess, you know, really my family bought that device more as a kind of an investment for the future, because surely the prices are going to go up with global supply chains as they are. And surely there are also going to be some, you know, dedicated big blockbusters and not just the stream of, you know, 5-year-old games that are now finally out on a Nintendo platform.
Yeah, I've been making good use of mine. Well, my daughter has been, at least. We just got the latest Kirby game. Just got a big re-release with some extra content. So we've been playing a little bit of that together on the Switch 2, which has been fun. And, of course, there's more Pokemon coming very soon, but more on that a little later. A couple of appetizer topics I did have just quickly here, largely connected to those YouTube videos I was watching. I mean, it was something I had discussed in our Game of the Year episode last week, but I think ended up cutting for brevity there, is that I was watching a couple of videos from the Video Game History Foundation. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, Mark. They recently, I think at the beginning of last year, basically uploaded a huge cache of like old video game magazines that you can browse for free at your perusal.
Yeah, I've been following their social media feed, and I think I've mentioned before that they've done some interviews on, I think, is the Fun Factor podcast, sort of revealing some of their activities. And I actually did end up watching maybe one of the same videos that you did. I think it was the big NES coming to North America video that was about, I think it was about 40 minutes long, so a pretty in-depth little documentary there. And it was really well produced and quite fascinating, fun watching that, because it talks about holiday console sales for the original Nintendo when we just got the latest Nintendo console for the holidays. So that was a good watch for sure.
I don't think I did catch that, actually. The main one that caught my attention was actually a little documentary on Sega TV, a phenomenon that I don't know if we actually got in Australia. We were not a Sega household. Were you familiar with this at all?
Only in catching snippets here and there in the video game magazines of the time. I couldn't justify it, the price of it, because I think it was a subscription model, if I wasn't mistaken.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what the release was outside of the US, how widely available, how expensive it was, but it was a fascinating little piece of technology. It was basically like not so much a television channel, it was basically almost like a prototypical Game Pass, where it had a selection of things that you could choose from on demand, like both full games, game demos, various videos and other things. And this was before wide internet access. It was all over the coaxial cables. A fascinating piece of tech in the early console days there. So, I mean, I don't have much fondness for Sega. I'm only just now starting to explore some of the backlog there. But, as a cultural moment, that seems like it would have been a wild experience to live through.
Yeah, there were some interesting offshoots now that you mention it. I mean, the Dreamcast is one of the earliest examples of a console shipping with a dedicated modem. I think it was the first one, I think even before the Xbox, the original Xbox shipped with, of course, the broadband modem. But the Dreamcast shipped with I think it was dial-up, if I'm not mistaken. There's some other competing platforms that tried things that are a little bit different from cartridges. So I think, I forget who it was, but the Satellaview, was that Sega as well?
Doesn't ring a bell.
Possibly. And then the Famicom Disk System as well. The Famicom Disk System, not being in network connected, but just the fact that you would kind of take discs, go to a retailer, write on the discs, and take it home. Just a fascinating kind of new game delivery system. And Nintendo and Sega, let's just say, have been really, have tried some things out in the past. Not at all. Yeah, exactly. Not all of them have been super successes. But, you could even think of the Game Boy card reader, where you could just, like, swipe a magnetic card.
Or your Pokemon cards.
There's Street Pass for the DS and DSi. Really, really innovative ways of transmitting data in a kind of a non-typical fashion. So it's a little bit sad that in North America, we kind of didn't really get the full brunt of all of those alternative platforms. You know, I feel like Street Pass, even although it did make its way over here, was really meant for kind of like the busy Tokyo and Osaka subway systems or something like that, where you're passing thousands of people per minute and exchanging data kind of wirelessly there, just like hidden, just something romantic about it, the possibilities of it all. Really cool innovations.
I was reminded watching that Sega TV thing, that we actually had something called Sega World in Sydney growing up. It's long gone now, but it was like an indoor theme park, basically. So that's most of my Sega nostalgia is actually tied up with that. I don't remember any actual like characters being there. It was mostly like a few like virtual reality or more alternate augmented reality sort of games and things. There was a big arcade inside there, but that was most of my nostalgia.
Yeah, of course, you know, I have intimate experience with Sega arcades in Japan primarily. Not really any here in Vancouver growing up, to my recollection. But I think since most of Sega's arcades shut down a few years ago, it was a really big shift when, you know, the Gigo sign replaced some of the Sega arcades all throughout Akihabara in Ikebukuro and places like that. But to my knowledge, the one last bastion of Sega theme parks is still at Odaiba in Tokyo on the man-made island there. And it's, what is it called? It's called Joypolis. And it's got indoor roller coaster, VR rides, you know, Sonic plushies galore, you know, shooting galleries, you know.
Sounds very similar.
4D yeah. rides and all that sort of stuff. So it's still going strong.
Awesome. Yeah, it's, I mean, a lot of that tech is pretty old hat now, but when you're 10 years old, it was pretty exciting stuff. Just one other quick video I wanted to shout out also from the Video Game History Foundation is I think it must have been earlier last year they released this. It was basically a GDC talk called Preserving Game History that you can watch for free on YouTube that I found really interesting, and partly just talking through their philosophy and the process they've gone through in collecting and archiving all this old video game material. And as I said, this isn't video games themselves. This is like magazines and production materials and a lot of the craft that accumulates around the video game industry, I guess, in various ways. It's something I brought up last week, but I ended up cutting, was that they basically discussed how so much of these things are only available because people take things home. Like, taking things home from work. I mean, we've all heard the story of, I think it was Toy Story 2, that was like deleted, or they lost like the movie, except some, like one staff member had like taken a copy home unauthorized and like saved the movie basically. And that's like how we have a lot of these things, is, you know, it's not in the interest of corporations to keep things and catalog, you know, our history, but there are people out there fighting the good fight.
Well, I was always told on the school ground that so-and-so's uncle works for Nintendo and they had the NES2 direct from Japan just sitting there waiting to be played. So I hear a lot of rumors about people taking hardware at least home, for sure.
Yes, yeah. It did ring some interesting points. It's like, this is the difficulty, the unique challenges that the video game industry faces in archiving these materials. I mean, you think of all the magazines, and they're talking about just how difficult it is just to run OCR on these video game magazines, because all like all these wacky layouts that they were, you know, really edgy experimental formats that computers are hard to read, so it's hard to automate a lot of that process, basically. I've been enjoying looking through some of those magazines now. Whenever I play a retro game, it's been fun to like look up some of the magazines and the contemporary opinions at the time. I think I'd mentioned like Phantasy Star 4, which is now considered to be like a classic and the peak of the series. You read those contemporary reviews and they were all pretty tepid. So it's interesting to see how our perceptions change through the years.
Yeah, it's true. Nostalgia is certainly a kind of rosy-colored lens. It's good to kind of wake up and read the original source material and see that maybe our opinions aren't so kind of universally held. Or they just didn't know what they had back then. Like, history is hard to see it when it's happening around you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was just reading up on some an issue that was specifically talking about the release of Pokemon in like its first year and how people were completely taken by surprise. Like, there was no expectation that it would be such a huge phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, based on what was happening in Japan, like, they should have known that such a phenomenon could take over here. I guess it was really the TV show that kind of blew the doors open.
Because by the time it came out in America, the TV show was already out. Because it was an interesting mix, where usually the anime comes first and the game is based on that. And Pokemon is one of the few exceptions. But perhaps while burying the lead there, I think we should officially jump into our main course.
Yeah, let's do it. So you said that we're going to be, this is kind of a big feature game But really, this is kind of like a platform, right? This is like a continuum of games all related to, what's that word, Pokemon or Pocket Monsters, and in this case, a specific flavor of it, Pokemon TCG, the trading card game in particular. So this episode, we get to have both sides of the coin represented. We're talking about tabletop games and video games, and I think we're going to be talking about, I guess, four main platforms, if you want to consider it. So there's one cartridge-based TCG game, to my knowledge, Pokemon TCG for Game Boy Color, which is currently available on Nintendo Online. So you can go play that if you subscribe to that platform. Of course, there's the venerable physical card game, which is still going after all these years. And then there's two mobile platforms that we'll be going into more depth about. Can you think of any other ways that people interact with Pokemon TCGs these days?
I mean, there have been a couple over the years that are no longer active. There was, I think it was called Pokemon TCG Online. I think it was the previous sort of official way of playing, which was actually published by Direwolf Digital, who we're quite familiar with. But there was a couple of other, like the, it's called like Let's Play or something. There was a whole series of like tutorial mini games, I believe. But as of right now, there's basically that four.
Yeah, and I guess related to the card game, there are a couple of box products, some of which that we've tried at your place, that are kind of like, try and kind of encapsulate, kind of extend, maybe like make it a little bit more board gamified, how to get into that game. But I guess that's all under the banner of the card game.
Yeah, well, I mean, I recently, a few episodes ago, talked about my experience with the Battle Academy box, which is basically the tutorial that will give you a couple of basic decks and run you through your first game. There's been three versions of that. Like, they basically update it slightly whenever there's a big new wave of, you know, what cards are standard, basically. Which I found an interesting experience, but didn't really contextualize the full breadth of what that game can offer. But I mean, before we get too much in the weeds, just to run through the information about the release of this game, that it was designed by Tsunekazu Ishihara, Koichi Oyama, and Takumi Akabane, developed at Creatures Inc., which is obviously a name you'll see for most Pokemon products. But it was released in Japan October 20th, 1996, so coming up on the 30th anniversary there. In the US, at least, and most other Western markets, it came out later in 1998, by which time the game, several waves of the games had come out, at least like the primary releases in a couple. I think Pokemon Snap and a few others were out by then as well. So Pokemania was well and truly in effect by then.
Right. I think we should talk about probably our first entry points into the game series. But just before that, building on what you said there, you know, Pokemon's really interesting. Obviously, it was a phenomenon before the TCG game. But I heard a quote once saying that the TCG game was one of, you know, after the television show, and of course, the video games, which we call, most would agree would be the kind of the core of the franchise. The, as far as North America goes, the TCG game is the first way that the Pokemon fans, kids, let's just say, really had the opportunity to fulfill the promise of Pokemon, which is to say, you got to catch them all. Unlike Japan, you don't have plushes and artwork or t-shirts of every single one of the, let's just say, the 500 initial generation creatures, right? You couldn't possibly catch them all. Maybe you can get a Pikachu at McDonald's in your Happy Meal or something like that. But probably if anyone went to Toys R Us at the time in North America, say, maybe there might be two or three Pokemon-related creatures, just the most popular, maybe just the starters or something like that. But the card game is what allowed kids for the first time, and, you know, adults too, to rip open some booster packs and have the opportunity to collect one of every Pokemon kind that they featured on the TV show and certainly in the video game. And so that was really what made this game platform popular. And also, unlike other popular TCG games like Magic or Yu-Gi-Oh!, there is a whole audience of people who are collectors of the cards that are not players of the game.
Mm, yep. I mean, I was collecting these cards when I was, you know, 10 or so, never played the game once until just a few months ago, basically.
I would argue that the vast majority of people that do collect Pokemon TCG cards don't play the game. Maybe they might have played it once or twice, but they probably collect the cards, trade the cards, talk about the cards in the schoolyard, whatever, have binders of the cards in nicely organized or whatever at home, stacks and stacks or shoeboxes or whatever, that have never touched the game or even desire to touch the game. So that's an interesting phenomenon that you can't undersell. Like, that's a big difference from some other TCG games out there.
It is a very obvious translation between the collectability of the characters, the Pokemon themselves, and this the trading, I guess. I mean, so I was watching a video, another video I was watching over the break was, you recently recommended this video channel called Datalog, and they just released a video on the release of Pokemon Red and Blue. Going into the detail of not those games themselves, but the lead up into them and the previous games from those creators, and some of their inspiration, and that was really fascinating in of itself. But like hearing them talk about how important like the act of trading was a big influence and inspiration in what they were trying to achieve with the video games. Obviously, that's why you've got the two versions, your red and your blue, or it was red and green in Japan, and then blue came out after, I think. But that's the source of these different versions, is to encourage people to trade and to interact, especially, you know, on those busy city streets, those metropolitan places where there's a lot of people around, you know, getting people together and trading, but also outdoors as well. I mean, Pokemon was originally on a handheld device, and it was designed to be an experience where you could be out in the world at the same time as you're playing a game. And so it was always envisioned as a very social experience.
Right. Yeah, kind of like a proto, you know, even before Pokemon Go, and we're not talking about that game platform, but, you know, the Pokemon as a concept arose from the very Japanese phenomenon of bug catching. And I visited Japan just this past summer, and let me tell you, that country is crawling with bizarre, creepy, crawly creatures, especially along the coastline, along the waters when the heat is hot. So I understand that bugs would just be on the minds of kids in particular, because, well, they're out there, they're free. You don't have to spend money to look at them, to capture them. And in the case of another, probably the cream of the crop is the Kabutomushi. Kabuto, you might be familiar playing tabletop games, Kabuto Sumo. Kabuto means helmet, and it's the name of the giant rhinoceros beetle. Kabutomushi, that is the king of fighting insects, and Japanese children, probably not so much these days, but definitely in ages past, would collect them, put them on a stump or a table or something like that, and have them battle each other. And that was just the root concept of Pokemon, is you're not only doing the fighting, but you're doing the collecting, and you're kind of being bragging rights, and that's going to the gyms and taking over. Anyways, getting a little bit off topic there, but bringing that all back to Pokemon TCG, that makes sense that it would be on a portable platform and you'd play it there, and you could do the very same thing with the card games. You get the boosters, rip them open, and then Monday morning rolls around at recess or lunchtime, you're comparing your cards and seeing what shinies you got.
Well, should we talk a little bit about the actual mechanics and just... I don't think we need to go into too much detail, but what differentiates this from some of the other TCGs?
Before that, why don't we just do a quick intro of, like, where do we touch Pokemon TCG first? Like, you said that you collected them as a kid. I didn't. I was a little bit older than you, but, you know, maybe you tell your story of your experience with Pokemon TCG.
Yeah, I mean, I was never a huge collector. I remember it being really difficult to actually find them. It was a few months after the release that I was eventually able to track down a booster pack. And I remember having a single shiny Zapdos, which was the pride of my collection. I don't think I had that many cards, all things considered. I had a lot of other... I was collecting other cards that were more like I think the Power Rangers movie cards was one primary series I was collecting. But since I wasn't playing the game, I didn't really have anyone to play with or trade with. I wasn't really that deep into it. Because I was playing the Pokemon games around... I mean, I was playing Pokemon Yellow and then the Gold Silver generation was basically the peak of my interest. But beyond that, I'd sort of moved away from Pokemon.
Yeah. For me, I never collected the Pokemon TCG game. I had experience with Magic the Gathering from really early on, you know, kind of teen and young adult ages, you know, from the time it came out. So, you know, I was perfectly aware. But, you know, maybe people don't know the history that basically there was everyone was coming out with the TCG. You know, there was TCG coming out every week, if not five a week. And obviously, most of them crashed and burned. So hearing that there was one for this new kitty phenomenon Pokemon wasn't that really surprising to me. But I didn't collect them at the time. And probably my first experience with them would be as a uncle or whatever, having younger nieces and nephews before I even had my own kids. You just like see these cards like littering wherever a child would be found. These cards are just coming out of bent out of pockets and in jackets and lying on dining room tables and living room floors. Like these things just kind of clutter and collect like lint or whatever, wherever a kid would appear. So that was an interesting phenomenon to me. It's like, huh, they made a game, huh? You can't compare to Magic, can it?
My library recently had a display on things that were found in books that were returned, basically like bookmarks that people had used. And it was fascinating to see how many of those were Pokemon cards or playing cards of other forms. But I just found one of my old other TCGs that I'd briefly gotten into is the Lord of the Rings trading card game. Obviously there's been other variations on that, the LCG, but this was the original sort of film IP version of that.
Yeah, I played OG Netrunner when it was in TCG form before Living Card Game, you know, Star Trek TCG, there were so many, let me tell you. But yeah, for me, Pokemon TCG, like I was familiar with the cards just as a phenomenon, as kind of a toy phenomenon before I even tried a Pokemon game. Pokemon, I'd never really was into at the height of it. I was kind of too old by then. Even though I had OG Game Boy, which I loved, I guess that was, you know, collecting dust by the time the Pokemon games came out for it later. And I don't think I owned Pokemon Color until I was a grown-up. So, yeah, it was just really new to me. I'm just hearing, like, secondhand about all these sorts of platforms. So, like, you said you didn't play the TCG, is that right?
No, I don't think I had enough cards or friends who were into it to actually play the game. Mostly just collecting the cards.
Yeah, so my kids, you know, as they grew older, they started collecting cards. They went through a phase, as any child will. And I, you know, because I was into games, I forced myself to learn the game. And I found that it was actually pretty interesting. Some mechanisms that were similar to things I was experienced with Magic, and some mechanisms that were different. So I knew that there was something there. There was some core there that made it compelling to these kids. So maybe we should talk a little bit about them now.
Yeah. I mean, so my daughter had been accumulating a few cards over the years, hadn't shown much interest, but just like, only a few months ago, basically got hooked on the Pokemon on the anime. First of all, the Pokemon Horizons is the new incarnation of that, and from there wanted to start. Had basically dug up her old cards and wondered if her favorite Pokemon also had cards. So I picked up a couple, but I'd seen that Battle Academy floating around basically, and you know it's rated 6+. My daughter is 6, so I thought partly just for my own curiosity as to how that learning experience is, I'd pick that up, and she took to it real quickly. Her win rate is something like 70%, so I haven't been doing too well, and that's pulling very few punches. So yeah, she's really taken to that and quite enjoying it. We've picked up a few of the basically the pre-built decks. There's quite a wide range of those at varying complexities and price points, as you can imagine. But I've basically only played with those pre-built official decks so far. Perhaps we'll talk about it a little later, but actually building a deck is a little more complicated.
Let's talk about the game. Very high level. It's a trading card game, of course, like Magic. I think the deck size limit is a 60 card deck. Like Magic, there's these energy cards which act as mana to kind of fuel the actions of the card. In fact, there is no cost to play a card out, to play a creature out, I should say. And this is an interesting aspect of TCG, Pokemon TCG, compared to something like Magic. Magic has multiple colors. It has five on the color wheel, but Pokemon has many more because it sort of aligns with the Pokemon type scheme, which has existed since the video game. And there are, I think they vary, they've changed over the years, but they have at least 10 or a dozen
I
at
think
any
it's
given
about
time.
10. In the video games, there's like 18, 19 types. In the card game, they've condensed that down to 10. There have been a few changes over the years. I think Fairy was a type in the card game, but only for a few years. And like some other ones, like I think Dark and Steel and Ground are sort of tend to be congregated into Metal, for example. Or ground may also be fighting instead. Ground isn't a type in the card game, for example.
Right, and those Pokemon types lead into one thing that makes this game stand out from a lot of TCGs is that a lot of these types have kind of rock, paper, scissors like, have strengths versus other types, and then are weak to other types themselves. So that means that, if you thematically build a deck with one or two colors, definitely if you build a deck with one color of energy, then you put yourself out there definitely to anyone who has a color that's strong against yours.
It's a pretty hard counter, and I'm quite curious about that because it feels like it's a bit of an artifact from the video games. Like weaknesses are in that, therefore they should be here. But like in my experience, most of the decks have been single color. I know some of the at the high level competitive decks are going to be running multiple colors, but in most cases, you want these theme decks are going to be around one particular color or type. And in that sense, those weaknesses like basically decide the game before it's even started. So I don't find that particularly interesting. I know a lot of people play without that mechanic at all as a house rule and just ignore that. It does feel like a bit of an artifact, and it feels like it will work only if your decks were designed to be having a wide variety of Pokemon in your deck, but that's only if it really works at a very high level of play.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be differing opinions, and you and I probably don't cover the gamut of Pokemon deck design theory. I haven't built a lot of decks, I've built a few, but yeah, in the video game that I played, the strengths and weaknesses play a strong factor. But you're right, it's interesting in the physical card games how small that little tiny, tiny, minuscule strip indicating this Pokemon is weak to this Pokemon is strong against
I
this.
forget to check for it so many of the times, yeah.
It's pretty much designed to be ignored. And maybe that's to not scare some younger kids off, potentially. I'm not saying that this is a little kiddie game. I know that it's played at a fairly high level. In fact, a family friend has competed, a youth of a family friend has competed internationally in the game. So I know that you can be very serious about this game and play at a high level. But we should also consider all types of play, not just the elite play, not even the pre-constructed deck play, because some people might be coming at this from, I imagine that there's draft play, but
The
also.
thing, there isn't really. Partly due to the nature of the deck structure, like because decks are so built around having multiples of the same Pokemon, or like having evolutions of that same Pokemon. So it's not enough to just have. I mean, Pikachu obviously works, but if you want to have a Bulbasaur deck, you need to have a bunch of Bulbasaurs and a bunch of Ivysaurs and a bunch of Venusaurs, which isn't going to work in a sealed draft format. I've heard that there are some cubes you could do, but largely as a I love sealed. It's my favorite form of playing Magic the Gathering. I don't really see it working here, unfortunately. There doesn't seem to be much of a fan base around that. There are a few very niche formats, like there's a Commander variant. It's like the whole one copy of certain cards in your deck, of a 100 card deck. That seems pretty niche compared to Magic. It doesn't provide that sort of rich canvas for different game modes that Magic does, unfortunately.
Right. So we haven't touched upon other basic factors of the game. We said that it's free to play creatures, your Pokemon out, but there's a few different types. So there are, like the video game, there are the basic level. This is the first tier. Those creatures are free to play. One can be played in the active slot, and I believe that there's five other slots that are called the bench. I think this is a really interesting system. It mimics a lot of what the video game is doing, obviously. It's almost a exact mirror of that. But I think it just fits quite naturally and is an innovative aspect of this game. So while there are multiple Pokemon potentially out at a given time, it lets you zoom in the focus right on what's active, what can be active, what can be retreated, what your other player has in their active slot, what they have in their bench. It's making you think about multiple levels, but it's laser focusing it on just 1v1. Really, really smart, I think, design. And you have to put out one basic Pokemon to start. I mean, I think you actually get to, you must mulligan if you do not have at least one basic Pokemon in your starting hand.
Yeah, that's the only way you mulligan, and you're forced to mulligan, which is a little strange, because there are plenty of other ways in which you can have a junk hand, basically, but only if you don't have a basic Pokemon. The other thing, obviously, is that you're playing energy to these Pokemon to power up their moves. They'll have a move that might take anywhere from one to three energy. The thing here is, like, unlike Magic and others, where these energy or mana cards are going into a collective pool, here those energy cards are going onto an individual Pokemon. You can play one per turn, just like land, but it's attaching to that Pikachu or to that Bulbasaur. They don't share that energy pool. So if that Pikachu is knocked out, all that energy goes with it.
Yeah, all that momentum you've spent playing out those energy cards every turn, it seems like a waste. Of course, there's clever ways to get some of that energy back, potentially, as well. So that's a part of the strategy, is where do you play the energy? You don't have to play it on the active Pokemon. You might actually be thinking, hey, this one in my active slot is a sacrificial lamb, or it's just like a stopgap. I really better invest in the ones that are on the bench to make things go. And this should not be understated, but just the fact that you're playing the energy to power your move set is really, really different from just putting the creature out to begin with. It's a totally different philosophy from Magic, and I think is actually one of the kind of like trademark differences between the very most popular Pokemon game, or even like the secondary popular game like Yu-Gi-Oh! That makes this game stand out. You know, you have to be really smart about which energy you put out, depending on which energy that you get in your initial hands, especially if you have a multicolor deck.
Feels a little like a sort of a programmed card game. You have to plan ahead. There's a lot of setup for these big moves, both for, like, you've got to play your basic Pokemon and then level on your evolved levels top of that. You have to have set up the energy in advance. At any given point, it feels fairly obvious what you should be doing, but only if you've set up your board in the correct state. So you often don't have a lot of decisions to be made in the moment. Like, oh, I've got a Pikachu, he's got three energy, I should use the attack that has three energy. You often don't have a lot of options. It's limited to this very small menu of movesets you can use. Obviously, you could choose to retreat that Pokemon and bring in another one. You've got some item cards that you can use to shift up the battlefield a little bit. But largely, it's going to come down to how did you program out your turn in advance.
Right. So building upon the rules instructions, we talk about basic Pokemon. They're free to put out. Then they have multiple evolution levels after that. There's at least level 1 and level 2 evolutions. I don't know if there's more beyond that, but 1 and 2 is what you typically see above basic.
There are other various special cards. I know some of them have changed over the years with the various sets. We're not going to go too deep into the different varieties in the sets. We're just talking fairly big picture here. There have been things called Pokemon EX cards, G-Max cards, V-Max cards, V-Star cards, all these variations on ultimate versions. I think Mega Evolutions is the current one in the current release the current wave of cards that they're releasing. A lot of those, basically, you have to get to the stage two and then mega evolve. So there is a real sense of ramp up to get that payoff. But others are also just a basic version. There might be a Charizard that's just, it's still a basic Pokemon, so you can play it right now. Charizard EX, you don't have to evolve it, you just play it there. So those are very powerful cards, and there is a discussion to be had on maybe some power creep that we can have later, but there are variations on that core sort of play your basic, play your evolved.
Yeah, certainly. So a lot of the strategy comes in, you know, like any good TCG, in the building of the deck. You have to build in some flexibility, but mostly your deck is going to have one or two core mechanisms, one or two cycling loops, kind of a designed synergy that needs to be in place. And now whenever you play, it's just a matter of executing and the other opponent potentially stopping you or neutralizing your strategy along the way. So it can be played at a high level, but I think you're right. I think moment to moment, it is a fairly simple game, and it's kind of like dealing with, will I get the card that I want? Can I force the matter and utilize secondary supporters or items to do that? And I guess decks are going to be a balance of creatures, supporters, and items. And I think there are some other types of field cards, if I'm not mistaken.
Stadiums.
Stadium cards.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the main point of friction, like the interesting decision points that you're making moment to moment, is, again, when to retreat Pokemon, because you don't want them to be knocked out, obviously. I'll get to the win conditions shortly. But also, where do you play your energy? Right, so you say you've powered up your primary active Pokemon. Now you've got for other energy. Where do you start putting that next? Or if you think this your current Pokemon's being knocked out, maybe it's not worth putting an energy on there. Maybe you start planning for your next turn. Or if your primary active Pokemon is knocked out and you don't have any others with active with energy, sort of powering them up, perhaps you put someone out there to sacrifice for a turn or two while you power up a third Pokemon. So that, I think, is the key friction, is setting yourself up for a couple of turns ahead.
Certainly, yeah, you gotta keep yourself alive while that ramp up to execute upon your strategy is happening. So we talked about a bunch of different types of cards. One that I failed to mention was special energy cards. So there are basic energy cards of the types that you might expect. Some abilities will be powered by any, as in, you know, colorless, essentially. So if you have any energy applied to that card, it counts as colorless. And in fact, there are colorless creatures and decks that will leverage that. You can include these creatures in your deck, even whatever energy you end up having. But there are actually even special energy cards that behave in different ways. Maybe they go back into your hand or something like that after they get discarded, or they help you move a Pokemon from your bench into your active slot when you assign it. So there are some variations within those strategies as well.
Yeah, I've not actually encountered any of those, either in the online versions of the game or in the physical decks that I've picked up. And those are fairly advanced decks. I know, Magic the Gathering is a huge, strategy and theory crafting aspect around, dual lands and other forms of special lands. I've not really encountered that so far, to my experience, in the Pokemon game.
Yeah, I think I certainly have, but I think it must have been in one of the video game forums that we were playing. I don't know if it was the old Pokemon TCG on Game Boy or if it was one of the newer ones like Live or Pocket. Let's talk a little bit about the win conditions of the game,
yeah.
And then maybe we can talk about the different versions. You start talking about win conditions here, and actually I think this is a really cool aspect of this game design as well, is that when you start a match, both players have to intentionally put aside six cards from their deck. So they just put them off the six off the top, put them face down near you, and those are your prize cards. So your prize cards are composed of your own cards from your deck. So unless unless you defeat your opponent's Pokemon and force them to retreat, or faint, or whatever the safe terminology
knockout,
is.
I think.
Knockout, sure. Then those cards are locked in there as your prize cards. There may be the key critical card that you need to make your strategy happen might get locked up in one of those cards for the entire duration of the game before you even get your strategy to happen. But on the flip side, if you knock out an enemy Pokemon and you collect one of your prize cards, you flip it up, and that card instantly goes in your hand, which totally drastically changes the momentum of the game. Potentially, it might be just the card you need to execute on that strategy at the time you needed it. So that's a very exciting aspect of the game, I think.
Yeah, it does obviously create these little mini dopamine hits. It rewards you mid-game for performing well. These little mini thresholds of success. In the decks I've been playing, oftentimes there's only one or two copies of these of key cards that might get locked in there. So that does create some friction. I'm guessing in like competitive decks, everyone's going to have multiple copies of every important card. So perhaps it doesn't matter quite so much there. But it does create some variance, and just again the little loot box of a kickle. What will I get now? It's a little reward that is nice. It is, my understanding is that the primary way that most matches will end is when someone collects all six of their prize cards, i.e., they have knocked out six of their opponent's Pokemon, then they win. There are a couple of other variations or other win conditions. One being if your opponent can't draw any cards. If they've gone through the whole deck, then they lose. The other one being, which is a little more interesting, is that if you knock out their active Pokemon and they don't have any on the bench, then you win, regardless of how many prize cards you've taken. And that has come up a couple of times playing with my daughter. It often comes down more to like bad luck of the draw. And I guess some aggro decks probably work well in that sense, and trying to you know, move fast and break things before they have a chance to build up their bench. But I don't think it comes up that often in most games.
Yeah, you definitely see that in the TCG game on Game Boy Color that I've been playing. Is like, oh, why did the match end up so quickly? Basically, in that game, you have most kind of little peons that you fight with along the way. You fight for four prize cards, so the matches are a little bit shorter. And then only the gym leaders will you fight a six prize card match, which is the full length. So some of those end up going really fast if you defeat the guy and you don't have any Pokemon on the bench. So that rule has been around for a while, and it makes a lot of sense that's there. You mentioned duplicate cards. There is a restriction, like Magic the Gathering, of having only a certain number of duplicates.
Four copies
of
each card.
Four?
I think, yeah.
Yeah. It's fairly standard in card games, it seems. And I'm sure that there's card types where you can only have one of a given type.
There's a couple of those special super ultimate ones, yeah. But you were saying with the varying the number of prize cards, that's another point in that it does create a natural way of controlling the length of a game, especially with the tutorial, the Battle Academy game that I've got. I think it suggests you play with four. There were a few basically demo decks that I got that are only like 30 or 40 card decks, and they're designed to be played with three or four prize cards. The other thing that's come up twice already with my daughter is basically sudden death. If both of the active Pokemon manage to knock each other out at the same time, which can happen because some Pokemon will damage themselves as well as the opponents, then you go to sudden death, which is basically you play a whole new game but with a single prize card. So first knockout wins.
No, that's really interesting.
And she's won both times.
They have a contingency for that. That's really cool. Another aspect that we haven't talked about that's not really in the rules per se, the structure of the rules, is that this game is heavily based on chance. There are the game ships with a chance cube. No, it's a disc. It's basically a coin. You flip a coin. So many aspects of this game are based on flipping coins. Sometimes they have you flip multiple coins. So an example might be this creature, when he attacks, flip three coins. Every time it's a head, score 20 damage per head or something to that effect. So this game, that might be a reason why some would qualify this as a kid's game, a kiddie game. It's highly chancy.
Pokemon
name, Pokemon name reference in there. And that's just a factor of reality. It's built into the spirit of this game, and other examples I'm sure exist from card matches you played.
Yeah, that is one of the things I've struggled with a lot is how much variance there isn't here. Obviously, games that have the physical energy mana cards in the deck are all going to be naturally pretty swingy in that sense. Mana Screw is a thing in this game. It's a thing that continues to happen. It's not just your first hand where that can happen, because in Magic, the Gathering, like, even if you've got a low mana on your opening hand, you might get some, you'll be able to draw some out, and then it goes into your pool, so that will stabilize. Whereas here, if your Pokemon gets knocked out and you don't have a backup Pokemon already set up with energy, then that's going to set you back again. Like, because energy is going to discard, you can continue to suffer from Mana Screw over the course of the game. So that's something that keeps coming up. You've got the chance of the flipping coins when some Pokemon attack. You've got the what might be locked behind your prize cards there. You've got, what's the other one? Oh, sorry. The other thing being just evolutions, because it's a game that's inherently tied to comboing. Like, you might get all of your level two, you might get all your Venusaurs, but none of the Bulbasaurs. You can't do anything with those cards. They're just dead weight in your hand. So there is a lot of variance. You're going to be, I mean, most TCGs are going to come down to trying to control the variance, essentially, and level out that luck. But I think there's so much luck to begin with in this game that the structure in which it takes to level out that is a little extreme. Largely, that it comes down to most of your deck, in many cases, 50% of your deck is going to be item cards. At least in the decks that I've bought and played with, the pre-built decks, most of the decks feel like they are, search your card for a basic Pokemon, search your card for a supporter card, search your deck for an evolution card. And it's like a lot of consistency in that way. But that also means you're searching through your deck a lot, you're then shuffling your deck a lot. And so it's like every turn, like once or twice a turn, you're shuffling your deck. And because I'm playing with my six-year-old daughter, I'm shuffling her deck as well. So that gets pretty tedious after a while, I will say.
Yeah, I think ultimately the chanciness and the potentially short duration of these matches is baked in. It's intentional. It is to account for the kind of the playground recess matches, the playing, you know, on the ferry, you know, on the way to the other shore. You know, like, this is for kids playing in the backseat of their car on road trips as well. Is, you know, while this game can be played at a high level, I think they have to bake in enough chance and randomness so that maybe little brother, little sister can eke out a win over older sibling every now and again as well. I think that's part of the spirit of this game, and that's not a bad thing. It's the designers know who their primary audience is, and obviously there's a way for adults to play. You find enjoyment playing with your kid as well. So it's a value judgment, I suppose. It's not a negative, let's just say.
The best TCG is the one you're playing with your friends or your family. It's often so hard to find someone who's willing to play with you, who's on the right level with you. And I think, not to sound too negative on this game, there is a lot of inherent appeal to it, both in the Pokemon themselves, like just the engagement with these characters. You can build a deck around your favorite Pokemon, and just that inherent familiarity with those characters is quite appealing. The that comboing system of playing the level one evolution on your basic, playing the level two evolution on the level one, like, that's very satisfying. It's very like put the round peg in the round hole. It just feels very elemental and primal. Like, ooh, that feels good when you get that combo to work. Right, so I do enjoy that aspect. It is a little bit repetitive for me. It's partly just because it's we're playing with pre-built decks, and I think like playing Magic: The Gathering, I've always preferred sealed. I don't think that my issues with, you know, the repetitiveness of playing with these decks is unique to Pokemon. I think Magic: The Gathering has the same thing. If you're just playing competitive decks, that's not what brings me to this kind of game. I want to improvise and have a little more variance, whereas this game feels like it's designed to force you into a very specific track to play this very specific combo of cards. And once I've played that deck a couple of times, I don't see a lot more appeal on that.
And let's be honest, there's a reason why we play TCG games. If we wanted a game that was entirely skill-based and not up to chance, we'd be playing chess or Go. We wouldn't be playing TCGs of any kind, because what is a TCG game except a game where you shuffle the deck? And that's where ultimately the root of chance comes from.
That's what I keep telling myself every time my six-year-old beats me.
There you go. That said, let's talk about the specific iterations of the game that we played. I don't know, what order should we go? Should we go card game first, maybe chronologically? What do you think?
Well, you want to talk a little bit about the Game Boy game, right?
Yeah, I certainly do. That's the version I have the most experience with. I've been playing the most here, even though it is on the
Nintendo Online.
Nintendo Switch Online, so you can play that on Switch. Just Game Boy games, they just feel much more natural on the Game Boy-oriented screen. That's why I'm holding up my Trim UI brick here, which has got that vertical display. It just seems like such a natural fit. And the widescreen of the Switch doesn't really do it for me. So this game is really quite cool. It's quite rudimentary in its graphics, but it accomplishes a whole lot. It's a fully fledged virtual trading card game. And, close listeners of the series will know that I'm a fan of digital card games. You mentioned Direwolf Wolf Digital earlier in the show. They create Eternal, which is a game I still play regularly. It's a digital only card game that I play regularly. I played Magic the Gathering Arena and the Path of the Planeswalkers or whatever platforms before that. And I've even played a smattering of Yu-Gi-Oh! Games in digital form. In fact, that's how I learned to play Yu-Gi-Oh! Is by pirating some ISOs on PSP. Of course, I don't pirate anymore. I bought, I think there's actually some Steam versions of Yu-Gi-Oh! That you can buy, and there's mobile as well. So I played a lot of different games in digital form. And the key distinction of quality for a digital TCG is, can you actually play the game? And this small microscopic UI does a surprisingly good job of conveying the information.
A lot of information packed in there, yeah.
There's a lot of menus. The UI is a little bit awkward, but it covers the basics. You know, this game is probably pretty slapped together pretty quickly, recycling a lot of assets from the early top-down original Game Boy Pokemon games, because there is an overworld. There, it's not as detailed as the original Pokemon games. Basically, it's just the map. You walk from gym to gym. There's nothing in between. And the gym environments themselves, they're basically like three rooms. Most of the assets are just reused. And maybe like the primary room in the gym might be themed like there's this science gym, and there's like these Game Boy style machines in the background. Whereas the aqua, the water themed one, has like a swimming pool. And the gym leader is sitting on a reclining lounge chair poolside. So, and there's like pool umbrellas and things like that. So there's cute little touches there. But your player is just a little squat, super deformed guy. You go from gym to gym. You can deck build in this game, fully fledged. You can build up to 4 60 card decks. This game does some things that I don't like about virtual TCGs, which is they don't allow you to use your energy in multiple decks, which is to say, if you have 15 fire energy, you have 15 fire energy, and those 15 can only go in one deck. You cannot theorycraft another deck and also have 15 in that, despite the fact that you could set it up. I guess they're trying to emulate the verisimilitude of creating your own deck with cards from sleeves that you own. There is the excitement in this game of defeating your opponent. There's actually no drawback. There's no drawback at all for challenging a peon and having a match with them. You win, you get a prize, you lose, you don't lose anything. So it's very, very forgiving, and this is very, very gentle. But you feel, you know, happy when you win. And you typically win 2 booster packs when you defeat an opponent. They just gift you booster packs. You don't have to keep track of money or any other currency or things like that. And in this game, I'm genuinely excited to open a booster pack. There's you get some nice lush for the Game Boy screen artwork for the booster pack, but it's nothing like the newer digital apps that have the glittery, flashy lights and the swirly animations and the sound effects or anything like that. You just get to see the raw data of the cards, and that it's exciting. Another thing that's great about Pokemon TCG for the Game Boy Color is that there's nothing drawing you back. There's nothing pushing you back. except the desire to complete your mission and win all the gems and get all the badges. There's no pop-ups, there's no reminders, there's no timers, there's no virtual currency, there's no blind boosters you pay with real money. It's just a little adventure game, and you want to catch them all. It's capturing the spirit of the game, and just the gameplay is fun. You play AI with your opponents, and you know, I've tested it. If a hand goes wrong or I don't beat it with the enemy, I'm not ashamed to say that I've loaded up some game states. I played the first round again, and they're literally randomly shuffling the deck. They're dealing a different set of cards. It's not fake. It's real, and it plays in a solid way. And it's also a window in time. This game, I don't know when it came out.
Well, 90s? I did have some details here. It was released in Japan on December 18th, 1998. In North America, April 10th, 2000.
Right.
So a couple of years after the base games.
Yeah, I mean, the Game Boy Color was already... Well, the Game Boy Color was not that old, but the Game Boy was a super aging system by that point. I think it came out in 89, if I'm not mistaken. So the original black and white Game Boy. So this was low, low tech that we're talking about here. But surprisingly, they made a very playable game. The effects, there's cute animations to them. I love playing this game, and I found myself playing like just one more match, probably a match a night before I go to bed every night for a good long stretch there. And I'm still playing it to this day. I haven't played it intensely, but I have like 6 out of 8 of the Pokemon gym badges. So I'm pretty happy with my progress, and I'm going to continue playing it. It's my favorite Pokemon TCG game I've ever played. So, all right, a bit of spoiler there about what I think about the other ones.
I mean, it really is back to basics. I only played a little bit of this, partly because like I would have played more had I not been playing so much of the physical game with my kid. Like, I didn't need more of that, to be honest. The few matches I played, my main issue was that the starting decks that they give you, like you choose a deck based around Bulbasaur, Squirtle, or Charmander, you know, the classics, and it will give you a deck based around those. But those decks have like 2 or 3 colors in them, which are like pretty high variance. Like, they're not high power deck, but they have a lot of variance in them. There's a lot of opportunities in there to just not get a very good hand, which feels like a strange way to introduce people to that game. It takes a little while to build up a big enough collection to have a consistent deck.
Feels really real. I mean, they're throwing you into the depths. Despite the fact that I said it's very gentle, it feels like you're really collecting cards, really deck building, theory crafting, you know, what would make a good strategy. It's a fun simulation game, and that's what I like about a lot of virtual TCGs.
I mean, it probably is true to the fact, it probably is true to you being 10 years old, having, 4 booster packs and desperately trying to form a deck with those cards, right? But it's also, as I mentioned earlier, power creep is very much a factor in the current state of the game. And this is interesting. Like, it's the original 3 sets, I believe. It's like something like 250 cards, I think. And they're all, I mean, there are some powerful cards in there, but it's all very, it feels very much a walled garden. Like, a design set that's made to be in balance with each other rather than this huge sprawling pool of possibility space. I don't think we want to get too much into details, but like the current game state with all those EX and VMAX cards is getting a little silly, and does create like a lot of high variance modes of play, especially if one player gets their EX basic card out in the first round and the other player doesn't. That's going to create a pretty big advantage.
Yeah, it was very, very shocking to me. You know, you and I played, you know, maybe 4 or 5 games. I know you played way more than that with your kid recently. But it was very, very shocking to me, having played, you know, dozens of games on the Game Boy Color, of this game that's been stuck in amber for 20, 25 years. And is really playing this, like, quite quaint, early, early level of low power cards and really tried and true strategies, which still have some variance in them. I haven't touched all the cards. I haven't seen all the strategies, but having gone against a bunch of different gyms, I see that there's variety there. And you're right, it is sort of locked in. That's the disadvantage of not having online. And I don't think they made another Pokemon TCG game, but I know that they made multiple Yu-Gi-Oh! TCG games. And I guess that was the concept, is that they would use the same engine, they would release another game the following year, and that game would have the updates.
There was a sequel to that Game Boy Pokemon game. It was only released in Japan, I believe.
Yeah, makes sense. So, yeah, I'm sure once I beat the game, I will be satisfied with it. I'll be a little bit sad that I can't play it anymore with different cards, but I'll be happy that it was a totally enclosed experience. And you're right. I feel like in the new breed of cards that you and I were playing with, which I presume are kind of pretty much the latest meta, I feel like so much of the game can hinge on one card and one card alone. And I don't think that is the case with these old tried and true, you know, first three sets of games. Yes, there are these powerful cards, but there's so many safeguards built in, like the evolution ramp and things like that, that really slow that down into much less dramatic, much less chancy, variable state, where it's just like, he executed, he got the card first. I guess I'm cooked.
Well, that's something I didn't really bring up when I was talking about the appeals of this game. I do think that natural ramp that's baked into the evolution is quite nice. It's like nice gentle ramps of your basic Pokemon does 10 damage, your stage 1 does 20 damage, your stage 2 does 40 damage or so. Like that provides a sort of ramp of damage, but then it resets and goes up again, and it's sort of a natural organic ramp over the course of the game. That ramp is like really, really spiky now in the modern game.
Just the fact that in the Game Boy Color game, I'm used to doing 10 damage, 20 damage, 50 damage. Whoa, that's a big one. You know, I'm feeling really putting the big, strong attacks out there now. And then the most recent game that you and I played, your guys have like 300 plus HP.
My Pikachu EX does 280 attack.
Right. Like, in my last game I lost to you, I was feeling, what's the point? I already got my guy wiped who had 300 HP or so. He was giving like 200 or so attack. I didn't have anything else that could possibly take out your guy before you one-shotted every other guy that I had possibly in my deck. So what is literally the point? I knew I didn't have any other cards in my deck because I had all those item cards and all those supporter cards that let me search my deck. So if it all hinges upon one card, why are we playing a game with 60 cards? Why don't we just play war or something until I flip my EX Pokemon first and then I win?
As I said, especially with the weaknesses, if you're playing with those at least, it can often feel like the game is decided before you've played the first card, essentially. And I don't think the modern standard version of the game does a lot to counter that. That's just pretty baked in, and it's only gotten worse as the game has continued, essentially. But with that said, I mean, I don't think we need to say a lot about the Pokemon Live version. We played a few games on that, but it's basically the same game. They do give you some decks to play with. I think they give you like 10 or so decks that are fairly powerful to mess with. And as a, I don't know if you played the tutorial, but it was pretty good, I thought, like as far as these things go, good at teaching you the game. It was one of these. It was fairly basic, but gets the job done in presenting the game.
Yeah, I played Pocket first, and I, you know, it was all the rage and still very popular now. So Pocket is the one that's a little bit smaller. It's more collecting forward, I would say. Definitely. It's the one where you log in multiple times a day. You have timers, and these affect how many boosters you can open, and they want you to pay more money so that you can open boosters faster. And there is a way to play the game, a cut-down version of the game, but I feel like it's really, really buried. And in fact, I played the collecting part of the game for a little while before I even learned that you could play the TCG game. I assumed that you couldn't, that it was just a collecting-focused app, which I think the vast majority of people, that's what they do with it, is they just collect shinies. But the cut-down version of the game that you can play has a limit of, what, 3 Pokemon on the bench?
Like, yeah, I think it's the active Pokemon plus 3 on the bench. Prize cards are only 3. That's limited. The curious thing, the biggest difference it does is that the energy is completely different. It basically, there's no energy in your deck. it just gives you one energy per turn to assign wherever you like. So it really takes out that level of variance, which I think is a good change, especially when there's so many other layers of variance already in this game. And just it brings it down to a tactical choice rather than an improvised panic of, oh, where do I put this? I finally got my one energy. What am I going to do with it?
Right. And so Pocket to me, like I signed off a long time ago. Like I have zero interest, negative 50 interest in collecting shinies of Pokemon. I don't know the name. I don't have a personal attachment to these characters. Never watched any of the series all the way through. Never finished a mainline Pokemon game all the way through. So, it's old news to me, of no interest. The live version, though, I guess it defines itself in comparison, in contrast to the Pocket version. It does seem much more fleshed out. Seems like kind of like the big sibling version. You get the full gameplay experience, and you have much less of the kind of exploitative, timed loot crate style experience. It still has some of that. It's got to make its money somehow. But it does feel like much more than the mature, older sibling, and that's where you would get to play out your full-on strategies if you're a serious collector of the card game and you play the card game to play the game.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you can just buy cards. I'm sure there's a way to buy things on live, but primarily it seems to be there to just to facilitate your in-person collection. Whenever you buy a product, whether it's a booster pack or a deck in like a physical product, you will get a QR code that you can scan that you then get a version of that to play in game. I don't know if the booster packs give you the same cards. Maybe those are randomized, but like any of my physical decks that I have, I could also play with against you, which is what I did. So that is good. I think that's pretty consumer friendly for what it's worth, and gets you extra use out of those products.
Yeah, it's actually really smart and, like you said, consumer friendly. I can imagine that game collectors, card collectors, they might be really into the concept of collecting physical games, but maybe they live in a community where there's actually not that much of a game space. Not everyone can live in Tokyo or live in Vancouver, for that matter. Maybe you live in a small community where there's only one game shop and there's no one your age that will play Pokemon TCG with you at a serious level. So,
well, you just don't want to risk bending your cards.
There you go. So all the games that you buy or all the constructed decks that you buy, you can have a real version in it. I think that's more consumer friendly than what Wizards of the Coast does with their Magic game and their very, very popular digital platform. They don't give you equivalent cards, do you?
I'm not actually sure. I'm pretty sure I bought like a Lord of the Rings starter, like two starter decks, and I'm pretty sure I got codes for those. But Magic doesn't really sell pre-constructed decks outside of Commander. It's not really as much of a thing. I don't know. I'm trying to think.
Pre-constructed decks for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, Commander is definitely a thing.
Well before Commander
was popular. But it's not as big of there's not many products on that sort of side of things right now, to be honest. It's mostly randomized booster packs.
Yeah. So we compared this game a lot to Magic. You know, obviously we say that because you and I, our breadth of experience is much more deep with that game. So that's our primary point of comparison. But I think we covered this game fairly well, all the iterations of it. I would really be fascinated to learn what the game was like, maybe at the in-between ground, like after 2000. Like, how was the game like in 2010? I don't know, but I'd be fascinated to know how the meta was different then compared to 2026, because I think the meta is pretty terrible. Pretty much all the decks I played with yours, there was a couple of clever strategies, a couple of the decks I enjoyed, but ultimately I was kind of felt skeevy at how it just really hinged on the one card.
Well, these modern decks are one-trick ponies, essentially. Like, how soon before you execute the trick, which like obviously is a big appeal to lots of people, especially on the competitive scene. That's just not what draws me to this game. I'd love to see a more casual version of this. Unfortunately, as I said, the way these decks are constructed, it's really hard to build like sealed draft sets. I am curious to check out, apparently there are some cubes, like you could build a very curated cube with a small selection of Pokemon that you could then play with and do slightly more improvised decks. So maybe I'll look into something like that with some like pauper cards. I'll see, but that's the largely the biggest downside to me is just it doesn't really support that wide sandbox of play styles.
Yeah, perhaps the most condemning thing I could say about Pokemon TCG, the current state of the meta, is that immediately after we played that last disappointing game, you and I decided to crack open two sealed packs of Keyforge Generation 1 decks. We played them. I never saw that deck before, and I played it and had a blast. All the fun tempo of that game came rushing back at me. I had made a really concerted effort to win early. I had forged two keys, and then just my engine ran out of gas. You roared back for a comeback for an exciting finish, and that game just like energized me and made me feel much more excited to play. We should buy some more packs of that game.
I know our Lorcana discussion also ended. Hey, would you rather just play some Keyforge? Yeah, I still really enjoy that game. But I mean, it does come down to, like, there obviously are a lot of different draws for why people play these games. You've got your whole, is it the Timmy, Jimmy, and Spike archetypes. For me, it's the discoverability and the improvisation of discovering, well, what does this combo of cards do, rather than forcing one specific execution. But that's just
me. I thought you played pre-constructed decks. Is there any construction that you do with the decks?
In Pokemon?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I've played with pre-constructed decks, but basically because that's all there is. Like, unless I just go out and buy a whole bunch of booster packs, which are very expensive right now, and try and force something with those. I mean, I could buy individual cards, obviously. That's going to be my next step, I think, because my daughter like really wants a Vaporeon deck. It's like, well, what's the cheapest Vaporeon deck I can make? I'll order some cards online and see what I can do there. But it requires a lot of extra work. It's not something you can just pick up some packs and play some kitchen table magic sort of thing.
Yeah, no doubt. This game, obviously, nothing we say is going to affect the juggernaut that is Pokemon TCG and its success level. Another interesting factor I thought of recently is that the game has a lot of hooks that connect it to the television series. Mm. And I suppose even the movies that come out. And let's not downplay the larger tentpole video games that also come out, is they have, you know, periodic tie-ins. A lot of the characters from the TV show will end up showing up as supporter cards and this and that in the decks as well. So I think that's a proud tradition that they've carried on since the early versions, and that's not going away. And that, I guess, brings people into the universe of Pokemon fandom that we talked about earlier. Not only can you collect all your Pokemon creatures, but you can also collect some of the supporting characters, Ash and Professor Oak and Misty and things like that, and all the new characters that surround it. That's another thing that cycles it back into the multimedia universe that is Pokemon.
Yeah, I mean, looking through the current generations of Pokemon, and it's very easy to be cynical. Like, these characters all look boring, both the people and the Pokemon, I guess. Like, this feels very uninspired. But then you see your kid like just fixate on one particular Pokemon, and like that familiarity is so strong. And it's wild seeing which ones they fixate on too. It's always one you least expect.
Yeah. Well, if you ever visit Japan, what they do is they do interesting things where every region of Japan, every small town even, has the ability to like adopt like one Pokemon. Not all Pokemon, but one Pokemon. So like this tiny little island might be all about Chansey or something like that, or Clefairy, and everything surrounding it, the manhole covers, the post office boxes will have Clefairy like adorned on it. And it's a very bizarre phenomenon. So even your home prefecture or town can catch them all in one way or another, or catch one.
Well, if you know which tiny town is the host of Snom, let me know.
I'm sure that can be found on the internet somewhere. Someone will let us know. All right, Daniel, I think we've talked a lot about Pokemon TCG. Do you think we even have time for dessert?
I could talk about something very quickly if you like. I don't know if you had nothing to discuss.
I certainly do. I'll try and make it as quick as possible.
Sure.
Would you like to go first?
Yeah, I mean, just very quickly, obviously over the break, catching up on some other media. Film that I really enjoyed. Very few films of 2025 that I actually saw last year. I have not had much time for films. Probably ended up being my favorite film of last year that I did happen to see, and that was Wake Up Dead Man, A Knives Out Mystery. This is the latest of the Benoit Blanc sort of mysteries, obviously, from Rian Johnson. I enjoyed the first one. The second one was fine, I thought. I got a little bit too into the parody and too focused on the subversion rather than just being an interesting mystery. But what I really enjoyed about this, about Wake Up Dead Man, I mean, for one, I'm always down for an expose of, you know, the hypocrisy of religion, which this definitely does, but does do that with a lot of nuance and allowing room for grace and faith within that, rather than just the bad sides of religion as well. So I thought it was had a lot of great human moments, as well as just being an interesting mystery and a good subversion of that mystery. It also just had a lot of humanity and explorations of faith and religion, and like it. Is a really inspired comparison there, I think, to the theatricality of the Catholic Church with the theatricality of, you know, Sherlock Holmes or Benoit Blanc performing the I solved it, this is how I laid everything out, and like taking pride in that. There's some interesting comparisons it draws there. And just the way that people have become obsessed with this almost religious fervor to an extent to true crime mysteries, I think. There's It does tie some very interesting comparisons that I really enjoyed. That was, Wake Up Dead Man. Probably my film of the year, of the few that I saw.
It's a rare opportunity where I've actually watched the film that you're talking about. I also watched Wake Up Dead Man probably after you started talking about it. I watched all three as well, and I enjoy that series. I think one was great. It was just perfect. Two, I think, was a better mystery than this one. But I feel like the third one was a really good like character portrait. I think that interesting characters. Some of them were sort of wasted, just you know red herrings. But I suppose every mystery series has to have some red herrings in there. Speaking of which, I'll be talking about a detective series of sorts. Funny how these things happen. I'm going to be talking about a book. This one is called it's the return of the feel good Japanese novels. This one is called the Kamogawa Food Detectives. And as far as I'm aware, there's only one of these books. But this is kind of like a series in its own right. So this is a short Japanese novel with an interesting premise. It's sort of like a mystery TV series, like Murder, She Wrote or Monk or something like that.
Columbo.
I think there's... Yeah, or Columbo. There's six chapters, I believe. In each chapter is like a case. And the premise is that the detectives are a father and daughter pair, and they happen to run a small, humble Japanese restaurant. And the father is a retired police detective. And the daughter is, you know, his daughter and runs the cafe with him. And they run the cafe just like normal. And they are very, very attentive to their small local audience. But there's a very interesting premise is that this detective agency promises to find your food. And what does that mean? Well, they put like a small cryptic like want ad in like a food oriented publication, and the a set of random strangers shows up every chapter, and they're basically trying to get the food detectives to help recreate a dish that they've had in the past. And this dish as ranges widely. They can be humble dishes, they could be fancy dishes, they could be highly technical dishes, or they could be sort of emotionally important dishes. And that's what's really fascinating. The challenge is, how are they going to do it? Because oftentimes, the dish that they created was from someone that's dead, a restaurant that's closed, from an estranged parent made this dish, was my favorite dish for them. And it's all up to the detectives to tease that out. What are the clues? What's the backstory? And how could they possibly recreate the dish based on things you could research or just know about the ingredients of a particular region or a time? So it's really interesting. You place yourself in the position of an audience watching a murder mystery, and you think, how could they possibly solve that mystery based on those facts? But just like Benoit Blanc, or like Columbo, at the end of each chapter, there's the explanation where they put the proof to the pudding and they reveal how they were able to recreate the dish. And I won't spoil each the chapters because there's a range of them. Basically, I will just say that the detectives almost always succeed at their cases. And even when they're ones that they don't succeed, maybe there was an important lesson to learn about not getting exactly what you asked for. So, Kamogawa Food Detectives, really fascinating, short, generally pleasant ride. There's some emotional aspects there. There's love, there's loss, there's all that sort of stuff.
It's a very compelling concept, like that idea of these sensory memories. Like, I've often been reminded of this very one specific type of chocolate that I can taste, like, right on the edge of my taste bud, that I can't quite place what form it was, where, like, I need to track that down, or a smell that will trigger a memory. They're really powerful, those sensory memories. So I can see a compelling read there.
Yeah, they really are. Every chapter is, of course, also a reflection of the client as well, right? They have some sort of trauma, or they have some sort of memory, some sort of hole, emotional hole that they're trying to fill. And food is so tied to sense, emotion, memory. And so this premise, I don't know why they haven't done it before. I think that one of those TV shows, I think, what was it? Midnight Diner or something like that. And one of them, it has a similar premise, is like, they have to create a dish that will satisfy the client or something like that. And it reveals something about the patron. It's, I guess it's tried and true for a reason, but I think this one really succeeds. It's a little bit sappy, but if you're looking for a feel-good story that's really well-researched, if you're interested about Japanese food, you'll learn things that, you know, a casual fan would not know about certain regional dishes as well. So interesting for a whole lot of reasons.
Excellent. That's been on my trade list. I'll move it up.
There you go. Check it out. It's available on Libby, our local library. The app, it's a worldwide app, but it's available in the Vancouver Public Library system through Libby.
Excellent. Well, lots of food for thought today. Long episode. It's good to be back, and it's good to have another sort of in-depth discussion. We've not had one of these for a little while. I know we wanted to a little more often since we've been following our new format. Hopefully, we can synchronize and have and do this a little more often, and then really dig into a particular game. Excuse me. There's Ted to say hello for the year. So, if you have any questions or comments on Pokemon or anything else we've discussed today, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. And you can check us out on YouTube, where we post videos of our episodes every time that they go out. And if you want to catch up on our older material, you can find our earliest episodes only in audio form on a podcatcher of your choosing. We'd love to hear your feedback either way there. Leave comments, subscribe, tell a friend to check out our episodes if they're interested in all manner of games like we are. And we don't have any ads in there. We do this for free, for fun. So your feedback really inspires us to keep going on and putting out more episodes like this.
Yes, yeah, always glad to hear from our listeners if you have any thoughts. So you can find me over at Blue Sky at Board Game Feast, and our OmniGamers Club account is there as well.
Yeah, and I'm MarkYuasa .bsky.social. So send me a ping about my incredibly wrong opinions about Pokemon games and TCGs. Love to hear it. And hopefully you will let us know what game you want us to cover next.
Absolutely. Yeah, lots of options for this year. I've got a few ideas. So let us know what you'd like to hear us cover. In the meantime, have a balanced diet of games. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.